Welcome to New Books in Sociology. I'm Sarah Patterson, one of the hosts here on the channel, and today we are talking to Renza Neuenhaus and Lori Maldonado about their new book, The Triple Bind of Single-Parent Families, Resources, Employment, and Policies to Improve Well-Being. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Sarah. We're really delighted to talk about Triple Bind.
Well, to get us started, can you tell us about yourselves?
Yes. So my name is Renza Neuenhaus. I'm a sociologist, mostly interested in economic inequality from a gender perspective. I've been doing comparative work on family policies and other labor market policies. I've done some work on the impact of women's earnings on household inequality and, of course, on single parents. I did my PhD at the University of Twente, which is in the Netherlands. Then I moved to the Swedish Institute for Social Research called SOFI at Stockholm University, and I'm currently an associate professor in sociology there.
And I'm Lori Maldonado, and I'm a scholar in single-parent families in the U.S. and across countries. And I just recently got my PhD from UCLA in June, so it's great. And now I am connected with the Stone Center on Socioeconomic Inequality, and it's based at the Graduate Center in City University of New York, as well as I teach at Columbia.
So how did this book come about for you all?
Essentially, it has a little bit of a backstory, of a little bit of a history, which is that the book came about from an academic debate that Lori and I used to have. We met when I was a visiting scholar at the Graduate Center in New York, and I was doing work on family policies, mostly focusing on couples and how women's employment was affected within couples. And Lori was doing single-parent families. And she basically critiqued me for ignoring the different dynamics of single parents.
And right. And then it actually kind of, that was Renza's first paper and a JMF paper, right? And then we started kind of to talk about how do we expand that to look at single parents. So we were really, that became our first paper that we wrote together, and it was on single-parent families and family policies. And it was a lot of fun to write. And then from that, I guess we just generated a lot of enthusiasm and energy around gathering researchers together to talk about single parent families. So, and back in 2013, Renza, is when we started kind of to host some seminars at conferences. And then we kind of started traveling as well and went to Esbjerg, which was in Denmark. And we kind of started to do a lot of streams there where we were just gathering scholars to talk about single parent families. And I guess we were bringing some great people together, and we were like, whoa, this is really important work. And, you know, it needs to be put together in a story. And so that came the idea of the book, Triple Bind.
And then, based on what we had, we talked to the publisher, and after some reviews, they were very, very positive, and we added some additional authors to it, and eventually that became the book.
So if you can go ahead and set the stage for us first, maybe I was hoping you could tell us, what does it mean to be a single parent family? And also, why do you think we're so obsessed with single parent families? And then if you could sort of define what you see as the triple bind for us.
Sure. Just to take a little bit of a step back with the book, you know, and looking at single parent families, when we brought together about 30 scholars, and it really looks at single parents across more than 40 different countries. And this is really like hundreds of thousands of single parent families, right? So it's a really quantitative analysis that we're looking at. And single parent families, I don't know if it's our obsession with it, but the biggest thing is that their poverty rates are so incredibly high. So we see that, you know, I'm from the US, and, you know, we could talk about that particular story, but in the US, you know, one in two single parent families is living under the poverty line. So it's an area where we want to pay a lot of attention to. And that's kind of where we came from. And in terms of the triple bind and where that idea came, it was really like, that's what single parents across countries, that we were describing this concept of this is the experience where you're a single parent and you have one earner in the household, one carer in the household, and you have inadequate resources, right? And we can also talk about individual explanations and education and other sociodemographics, but that being a really big part of just having these inadequate resources, but also having inadequate employment and what that means. And so we see that a lot of single parent families are working, but they're working in low income jobs. So that employment context and the inadequacy of employment is something that we pay attention to. And then finally, you know, the triple bind is, well, boy, it's really tough when you don't have resources, you know, you have in inadequate employment, and it's difficult to balance work and family. And then finally, it's sort of this idea of inadequate policies, where they're just not enough. There's like not necessarily a social safety net that is supporting single parent families. So in the US, you know, that means really a lack of a social safety set for families. But we see different things in other countries as well. Did you want to add anything, Renzo?
No, I was more triggered by the obsession with single parents. That is, of course, very, very prominent in the US, of course. But my experience here discussing some of the early versions of, for instance, the introduction chapter, is that my Swedish colleagues were actually more challenging the whole concept of single parenthood, because here it's so much more common that both parents remain involved in the children's lives even after they separate, that the whole idea that is a single person is parenting for a child is less less applicable here. So it already there we see this very contextual differences in how single parents are discussed, and of course also how their position in society is. And more of an academic point, of course, the idea of the triple bind is very strongly gendered, right? So the resource, so first of all, the majority of those households headed by a single parent are headed by the mother. I think on average in Europe, it's 85% of those households. If you look at poverty or work history, for instance, the employment opportunities people have, or the type of family policymakers had in mind when they designed, for instance, their family policies, in all aspects, you see very strong gendered biases. And of course, those are addressed in many of the chapters in the book.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I really liked was sort of this taking this bigger picture across different countries, because my research background is in the States. And so I always think of, you know, the Moynihan report and those kind of early reports that were sort of sounding alarms. So what I really liked about the book was sort of this cross-cultural context that you give it. But in part one, you sort of focus on the first bind, which is resources. So, yeah, so go ahead and talk about part one for me.
Yeah, so it actually goes well with what you just said about the Moynihan report, but also we respond quite explicitly to McClanahan's Diverging Destinies. And this is this very prominent idea that single parents and their children have less well-being because it's mostly or predominantly lower educated mothers who end up in single parenting. And of course, we know that the lower education represents lower chances on the labor market. And for instance, lower educational opportunities for children. And it makes sense to think of this as a very US focused or US centered explanation. But when you look across countries, which is what happened in a chapter by Jo Herkonen, is that the lower educated single parents in the US, I think 7 out of 10 face poverty. But in other countries, that is more like 3 or 4 out of 10 or even 2 out of 10 of lower educated. And I think that's a really good example showing that it is not just the education that explains the poverty risk of single parents in the US. So of course, the lower educated have a higher risk of being poor. But the degree to which this is the extent to which this is the case really varies by context. And I think that's a very important case, a very important example of the of doing this kind of comparative research to put even those prominent explanations in context.
And just to add to that, what Renzo was pointing out, when we look at it that way across countries, you really can look beyond just sort of these individualistic explanations of poverty. And so a lot of the blaming of single parents that happens in the United States, it's, you know, when you look across countries, you can really take these explanations away and look at more structural explanations by looking at across countries.
Something else that I found really interesting in this part one was sort of thinking about like the definition of single parenthood. And even as just a researcher, you know, that some single parenthood is actually quite a transitory phase, as well as the idea of a lone parent. As you were saying, Renzo, it's like, you know, there might be another parent, they might just be in another household. So I was hoping you could sort of talk about those ideas.
Yeah, that's something we struggled with ourselves, particularly in these larger scale comparisons. It's of course very difficult to do justice to all these details. But we had some chapters, for instance, Morag Trianor, she really looks at, she has a several year panel study on single parents and other parents. And she really makes a distinction, a very important distinction, for instance, between parents who become single and then stay single, or parents who repartner, but also whether people are, or families are in poverty for a single year, but then recover financially, or that they are, you know, in poverty for a very long time. And of course, it's this persistent poverty which is much more more difficult to cope with for the families and also for the child well-being. Compared to, you know, one year of very low income or poverty income. So in that sense, this transitory phases are, of course, very important. Another aspect of that, but is a bit talking about poverty already, about policy already, is that very few single parents become parent when they're still single. And many of these inequalities of having a subpar job or not having a job, for instance, are related to what happens in a coupled household, doing gender in a coupled household, when the children are just born. And if it's mostly women reducing their working hours or not being employed, in these couples, you know, a couple of years later, the couple separates. And then, of course, it's the mother who is, on the one hand, more likely to take care of these children, but also to live in poverty or to have difficulties finding an adequate job. So those are examples of how this, what we call in the book, Hannah Zagel and Isabel Hübken, they have a chapter on the life course perspective. That really addresses these kinds of issues. And of course, also how the life courses in our countries have become much more diverse, as they address that as well. And then the other part of your question, Sarah, was that indeed so many families are still involved in, the both parents are still involved in their children's lives after they separate. In Sweden, we saw we've seen that increase very quickly. And in 2013, I think it's the recent data in the book, 35%. So one in three of the children whose parents separate, they live with both parents, and they live actually 50% of the approximately 50% of the time with both parents. And when there's a chapter by Sarah Fonton and several colleagues who look at the well-being on different dimensions of these children, and what that chapter shows is that these children living with both parents, that their well-being in many dimensions is actually fairly similar to that of children growing up with both parents in the same household. So, of course, this is perhaps it's a bit of a selective group of parents who manage to do this, but even if you know, if their level of education, that they're highly educated, if that's accounted for, these results still hold up. And it's at least a very promising finding that we talk often about the lack of resources of single parents. But here we see an example of that these resources are becoming more available to these children growing up with them.
And also, just thinking of the co-parenting in Sweden and how that has really changed our notion of single parenting and that shared residence. And Anne-Sophie Duvander and Nicholas Korsal, they do a really interesting piece because they look at how parents share leave and how fathers do take leave as well. And so it's this idea of you can actually have policies that support these families. And Renzi can go a little bit more into like the leave policy and kind of how that works in Sweden, but it seems to really support the family, you know, and gets both parents really involved, and they're able to share the leave or transfer the leave really easily if they need to for their families.
Yeah, absolutely. So this Swedish parental leave is gender neutral, so each parent, irrespective mother or father, the word mother or father isn't even available in the Parental Leave Act, I think, or is present. So both parents get the same amount of leave, and they can transfer part of that to each other. But currently, 3 months of leave have to be taken by the mother, and 3 months have to be taken by the father. If the family doesn't do that, the family loses the leave and also the payment during the leave. So that's a strong incentive to mostly get fathers involved, and that has been fairly effective. So these reserved months of parental leave been effective in Sweden, but also, for instance, in Norway to get fathers involved. And in Sweden, it turns out that even after separation, these fathers still continue to take leave, slightly less than fathers who did not separate, but still considerable amounts of leave to take care of their children after separation.
Yeah, I think there's a few chapters in part two, right, that really kind of emphasize things like leave or union coverage really matter in terms of gaining adequate employment. So I thought that those were a really nice addition to the book. So something you brought up before that I want to bring back up from part two is this looking across the life course in terms of, you know, I think it's chapter 8 specifically, they talk about how risks matter at different points in the life course. And so I was hoping you could talk more about that idea.
The whole notion of this standardized life course of you find a partner, you have children, and then, you know, this typical traditional breadwinner model, for instance, or male breadwinner model, and then you stay together. This sequence of events is getting more diverse, and also the ages at which people make these transitions or these choices are getting more diverse, and you see that, for instance, the poverty risk of single parents with very young children are much higher than the poverty risk of when the children are a little bit older. And the same goes for the employment rate of single parents, for instance. So, of course, and we know that from all kinds of research, the care responsibilities or the are more difficult to combine with regular employment, you could say, or paid employment when the child is very young, compared to when the child is a couple of years older. So when we analyze these kinds of processes, then, or policy outcomes, for instance, we need to consider which policies are relevant to which a single parent. So, for instance, childcare or early childhood childcare and education is really important early on in the life course, and school day organization of school days a little bit later in the life course for single parents. And so Hannah Zagel and Sabine Hübken, they look at these different kinds of policies. So about training early on in the parents' life course, you could say, about active labor market policies, but also at alimonies or in-work benefits across this life course perspective.
Well, something I think a lot about in terms of my own research about caregiving is this idea that, you know, especially in relation to single parents, is when in the life course they have you know, children and are lone parents, if they are, it really sort of impacts their accumulation of human capital, right? So it really determines. I saw a presentation recently, you know, about teen pregnancy and this idea that like maybe it matters more now because it's so unusual. Well, I mean, it's still frequent, but it's still unusual. And so maybe it has more of an impact today than perhaps it did previously. You know, obviously in the 1950s or before, that was, you know, people were much younger when they got married. And so just this shift in the life course and when things matter, I thought was really interesting to think about.
Yes. Although this specific hypothesis that you raised is really interesting. I don't think we specifically tested that in the book, but it seems to be very plausible to argue that now that we have so many more dual earner families, that to make ends meet on a single wage is of course more difficult, and that applies to all kinds of families. But if the human capital or the educational experience or early work experience is more limited early on in life course, the consequences might be more profound. I think that's a very plausible hypothesis. Indeed, yes.
So then in part three, you guys talk about redistributive policy. So I was hoping you could sort of bring up some of the stuff in that part.
Yeah, absolutely. If you allow me, I would then first to talk a little bit about one of the last chapters in part two, which is about how employment and health are related, because it sets up a good answer to your question. So mostly in Europe, this perspective or this paradigm, which is often referred to as social investment, which is the idea that government should try to activate their citizens, right, to support quality employment, to support employment, so that people can maintain, you know, maintain a good livelihood based on their wages and their independent employment or being employed. And sometimes that's argued to come at the expense of this redistribution, so like social assistance or child benefits or housing benefits, for instance. And what we did in these chapters, it's well known in the vast literature that employment is associated with better self-reported health. And of course, the causality goes both ways here. But what we did is to see whether that's also the case for single parents. And it turns out it is. So employed single parents report better health than those who are not employed. But I think the policy story of that chapter is that if countries invest in the employment opportunities of these single parents, so they provide public childcare, or they provide these what we call here active labor market policies, so try to support people, the unemployed, to find proper employment by training or public employment service, etc. Then, so these active policies, of course, they are somewhat effective in increasing the number of single parents who are employed. But among those single parents who are employed, you also see an even greater health benefit associated with this employment. And when you look, for instance, at childcare, this makes a lot of sense. So it prevents single parents not being able to hold on to a job. But for those who are employed, if there's childcare, there's much less stress involved in combining all the responsibilities they have on their plate. So these policies, they can, you know, increase the number of employed, but also increase the benefits of that associated with that employment. But what we also found in that chapter is that those who are not employed, and we don't know why they're not employed in this study, but for those who are not employed in these countries where many single parents are employed, they report slightly less good health. And for those who don't have employment, but in particular, the social assistance and child benefits prove to be very important in avoiding all too bad health, you could say, or the reporting worse health. And then the more general finding, I would say, of the section on this redistributive policies is that despite all these efforts of supporting the employment of single parents, redistribution still remains very important. Many working single parents live in poverty. And we see, there's a chapter by Jonathan Bradshaw and colleagues, that even among the employed, the particularly child benefits and housing benefits, they make up a considerable part of the incomes of working single parents.
And I think also, just to add to that, just the value redistribution, it's also the way that the policy design is. And so we kind of talk about Anne Morrison's, and she goes into this idea of targeting with universalism with child benefits, that that particular idea is really helps to lower the poverty. So it's really helpful to sort of have these universal designs, you know, the child benefit for all families. But then if you could target, you know, an added benefit, for a single parent, in addition, you know, that particular design seems to work well. So sort of that idea of, you know, things, you know, family policies are good for all families, but they're really good for single parent families. They really, really help in terms of reducing poverty and many things.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's one more chapter that almost sometimes keeps me awake, I would say, is it's a chapter by Bea Cantillon and colleagues. And What they show, and actually it's fairly straightforward analysis, but it still worries me, in the sense that their findings worry me, that the minimum gross wages in a number of countries are declining and actually fall below the poverty line. So if you work full time for this minimum gross wage, even before taxes, you don't on the single wage, like many single parents, you don't end up above the poverty threshold. And the response has been by several governments, to use part of the government budget to support these working single parents. This is by child benefits, for instance, or in work credits. And of course, that is effective in reducing the poverty among those single working single parents, but the levels of minimum income protection, so for instance social assistance, have been falling as well. So in societies where employment is considered more important to achieve economic well-being, it's more and more difficult for those who work for minimum wages or just above minimum wages to actually reach the poverty threshold. And for those who don't have a job or can't find a job or are fired, the minimum income protection level, you could say, social assistance, is increasingly inadequate in many countries.
Part four is sort of reflections back upon the whole book. And one of the things I liked each chapter individually, so I hope we can go through each one. But in chapter 19, the takeaway really is that we need to avoid talking about it in terms of a deficit model, about single parents, you know, as a deficit model. So I was hoping you could sort of talk about how we do frame this research and in some suggestions going forward.
Yes, I think you're referring to the chapter by Gideon Calder. My lab is dropping. Perhaps you just said that, but perhaps Laurie, you want to say something about that?
Yeah, that's Gideon's Calder chapter, and I think the piece is the idea of the social justice perspective, you know, and bringing that to single parent families, and that like all families, you know, deserve better. And so, yeah, I think that particular chapter, I think, really calls us to an asset-based, a strength-based model. And there's a one-liner in there. I wish, I don't know if Renzo knows it by heart, but I think it really hits home in terms. Yeah, go ahead. I know.
Yes, I think I know what you mean. Shall I try to quote the sentence here? We're on the same page. So what it says is that there is nothing inherent about the disadvantage single parenthood brings. For it to be seen that way depends on decisions about the distribution of resources in society, alongside dominant assumptions about appropriate family forms, which are contingent and up for revision. And it's this revision that we don't have the definitive and the full answer. But what the comparative perspective in our book does show is that there are ways that we can support single parents in a way that, that there is no, or at least very little, disadvantage associated with it. So in that sense, there are many, so many single parents that raise their children and to be just perfectly fine. And I think that is what Gideon Calder is trying to say here with the, there's nothing inherent about the disadvantage single parenthood brings.
Oh, a nice highlight about that chapter and about that author, you know, is he's a philosopher. And, you know, we're social scientists, and it was just great to have a philosopher, you know, economist, sociologist, psychologist, kind of a whole group of scholars really put their head around this this topic and the contributions. I think that chapter really says a lot.
And then I really also like Janet Gornick's chapter, and I'm familiar with a lot of her work from my own work. And she's sort of arguing, you know, we can't really take gender out of the conversation. And so I was hoping you could talk more about that.
Gender is baked in the triple bind, right?
I agree with what you just quoted, that gender is baked into the triple bind. And I think I said it at the top of this interview, that it's the majority of single parent families who are headed by single mothers. And so they do take the responsibility, but we talked about the US, they also take the blame and many of the consequences of, for a long time, nowadays that's changing, but for a long time, having lower levels of education, working, being less likely to work, or if they're working in lower paying occupations. And of course, this is, at least in some countries, very strongly supported by family policy models that are based on the traditional breadwinner model. So, indeed, it's very difficult to think about single parents or single parenting without considering the gender dimension that is associated with it.
And, you know, if we go, Janet Gornick is a great mentor of mine. And I think even bringing out the gender and one of the most important pieces of the triple bind, you know, and saying that gender is baked in the triple bind. This is a sentence from Renzo, but single parents do better in countries with institutions that support equality of gender and equality of class. So this idea of gender being so important, and going back to some of these traditional assumptions, you know, family policies being based, you know, in the breadwinner model, like in Nordic countries, or, you know, a country like Iceland, Edal writes that even the child benefits, you know, the way that they only provide them to the single mother, right? So, and that it's calculated on the mother, you know, their mother's income, right? And in some cases, the child can live with both parents. So just kind of just, there's sort of even these policies that we look at, you know, from these, you know, gender egalitarian countries, we still need to be really focused on how this interacts with single parent families, right? Because if we did really consider that child benefit, you know, and we took out those traditional assumptions, it would be much, much better for families.
Absolutely. And the sentence you just quoted, I think it says exactly that. But in addition to that, when we from a social policy perspective, or from studying social policies, I'm increasingly aware that when we talk about gender, we talk about family policies. And when we talk about class inequality, we talk about labor market policies and unemployment benefits, etc. And I think in all analysis of inequality, but when you look at single parents, those two sets of policies, so to speak, they closely intersect. And in countries like the US, where lower educated in general have great difficulties on the labor market to earn a living wage, that's a great indication of class inequality, the inequality between rich and poor. But of course, it's the single parents, which is very strongly gendered, who have in such a society great difficulties to make ends meet and to secure adequate employment, for instance. So when we talk about such a gendered topic as single parents. I think we, of course, we need to consider family policies, of course, but we also need to consider the labor market conditions and the labor market policies as well.
So then in your all's chapter, the very last chapter of the book, you give us some takeaways, but also some ideas for future research. So for any graduate students listening to this podcast who need an idea, I was hoping you could sort of give us the takeaways from the book, as well as these sort of things that you saw as opportunities for future research.
Just to go back to that single parents do better in countries with institutions that support equality of gender and equality of class, I think that's a really big takeaway. That was a takeaway actually after we finished writing the conclusion, and we keep coming back to that. But we do have five takeaways, and the first is inequality matters for single parents. So, inequality matters, poverty matters, that basically if we do tackle these things of inequality, then single parent families are going to do a lot better.
No, I completely agree. And I think in relation to that, and it's the second takeaway, is that policies that benefit all families matter just as well for single parent families. And of course, it's an enormous truism. And of course, we're aware of that. But it is a case for universalism. It turns out that if you design policies specifically for single parent families, it might actually turn out that these policies are not that effective in improving their well-being. And of course, there is an exception of child support, which can make a difference in single parent families. And this, of course, specifically tailored to single parents. But if you think about childcare. For instance, the public childcare in Sweden, here I go about Sweden again, it's very affordable. The quality is really high, and it is guaranteed to be available. And in Sweden, if you lose your job, or if you lose your health, or if you lose your partner, you don't lose your or at least your child does not lose the childcare. So it can go to the same center. It doesn't have to say goodbye to his or her friends. So that represents a lot of continuity to the child, but of course also to the parent, who then can work on getting better or to find a new job. And I think that is something that is, of course, not specifically good for single parents, but the whole point is that it is good for everyone. And single parents, just as well as all other parents, benefit greatly from these kinds of policy arrangements.
Mm-hmm. And then also the sort of really involving fathers, but involving both, the mothers and the fathers, and this idea of shared both providing for and both caring for the children. In a lot of previous research, we looked at single parent families and we just assumed that the fathers were missing. And in many cases, that's just not the case. And so it's really how to involve both parents into their children's life is really important. And so it's kind of back to the Sweden case, my favorite case, and the idea of even these policies really help fathers to take leave because separated fathers to take leave because they're really trying to get the parents to agree, to share leave. And that's really beneficial. These ideas, these policies that support shared parenting are really, really beneficial to these families.
Absolutely. And I think that the last two takeaways are that pretty much discussed before, but it's about the investments in employment seem to have to be associated with very positive outcomes. So if you actually support single parents to combine work and family, they do. And they have jobs. And also, it's not that they just have a job. They also have better jobs that are probably associated with better wages. We discussed about how they're associated with better health outcomes. We have a chapter by a colleague, Yongwan Bion, and he shows that if there's a better union coverage or if there's paid leave, the single parents are more likely to have a middle-class income, for instance, and also to lower chances to be in poverty. So these kinds of investments do seem to matter for single parents, but for those who, for whatever reason, don't have a job or can't have a job, of course, redistributive policies do remain very important, and also for many who actually have a job in these increasingly unequal labor markets of ours, redistributive policies such as child benefits and housing benefits remain very important. So I think those are the key takeaways, in addition to our argument about supporting equality of gender and equality of class. Laurie, do you want to talk about the recommendations for future research?
I think the biggest lesson is just looking at single parents and how do we, you know, what surveys, what instruments, what research do we have that we can capture single parent families better, right, in the data?
Yeah, we talk about that. Much of the research we've been presenting here, many of the studies are country comparative. We have some very detailed country level panels as well. But the challenge of many of these surveys is that they're sampling households. And when you talk about single parents, it becomes more important than ever, I would say, to look at the ties of the household members to people outside of the household. So very often the other parent, so to speak. Because those children, if you're interested in the children, they don't live in a single household, but they live in two, for instance, households. And everything that happens in both of the households, of course, will matter for these children. And we don't really see that in many of the current surveys that we have available. So I think there lies a huge opportunity for future research.
And there was, even in the Swedish chapter, they looked at registry data in Sweden. So that's like all the households in Sweden to look at how separated fathers share leave. And it was just such a point of access in things that we didn't really know. So looking at the fathers is becomes really important.
I agree. And then I think another, so we talk about the importance of the life course perspective, so which is also a way of, we need more longitudinal data, more detailed data about differentiation between single parents. There's no such thing as just a single parent, right? There's still diversity going on. But the other thing, but Laurie, I think you can say much more about that, is that we really need to expand our geographical scope. We in our book, we mostly look at OECD countries, which is high-income countries. But you started looking at other countries as well, right, Laurie?
Yeah, I think, starting to think about going more global for single parents, and looking more at middle-income, low-income countries. There's some opportunities to do that. Like I've done a little bit of that with my dissertation using the LIST data and the World Policy data. But, you know, it's looking at, I was able to look at South Africa and India, as well as some Latin American countries. So really looking at that, expanding to more than just OECD countries, but looking at non-OECD countries and what those new insights bring to us. So expanding the scope of comparative research to other countries.
Yes. And, you know, as a small footnote to that, of course, looking in more detail what's going on within countries, regional differences or differences between, in the US, of course, between states, or how municipalities implement national policies, let's say childcare availability, for instance. I think that's another venue for future research. We know very little about that, I think.
So what are you all working on now?
A lot. that's a great question, Sarah. I think it's so interesting. You know, the book, it was such an amazing project for us. We were both junior scholars, and, you know, we really got senior scholars and just great experts to be a part of it. And, you know, to kind of put together a 500 plus page book is a daunting task, but it really was such a wonderful experience. I think Lorenzo and I can agree to that, you know. And then after you write a book, you have so many more ideas and so many more places to go in the research, you know, that me as a professional researcher, but just where the field can go. I think it's pretty exciting. So my particular research, I'm again trying to kind of go more global to get more countries. And then I think in the long term, I would love to look at more about what this means to the United States and look at what shared parenting and co-parenting means more to the United States in the comparativist perspective. Go ahead, Renzo.
Yes, well, that sounds, of course, very interesting. And I agree with those directions that those should be pursued. I've just recently published two papers on how women's earnings affect inequality among households. And there I've been focusing mostly on, or actually only focusing on, coupled households. And, well, as the book shows, and of course, as everyone knows, families are much more diverse nowadays than, or have always been much more diverse than only couples. So I try to expand that line of research to better look at what the consequences of women's earnings are if you consider the whole diversity of family forms. And I'm not really sure what to expect there, because the hypotheses are pretty contrasting. But I'm very excited to look into that a bit further.
And Renzo, the diminishing power of one.
Yes, so that's a paper on single parents in Sweden. I don't want to say too much about that paper yet because it hasn't been peer-reviewed, but we used register data. It's a collective work with Kenneth Nelson and Susan Alm. And we used Swedish register data to look at poverty in Sweden. And people in always think of Sweden as the country of great equality. But it turns out that poverty among single parents in Sweden is rising really rapidly. And it seems to have to do very little with the availability of parental leave or childcare, which is still fairly generous and available and affordable. But probably it has to do with what is going on labor markets or with unemployment benefits. But regarding that, I would say stay tuned.
Thank you. Sounds like a lot of interesting work. Thank you again for being here with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us. And if I may add a little advertisement, yeah. I would say, or counter advertisement, perhaps it is.
Yes, please.
In case you're still interested in this book, please don't buy our book, because it has become so. There's a beautiful hardcover. It is, I think, really beautiful, available from Policy Press. But that we had a very generous grant from an initiative called Knowledge Unledged. And they paid the open access fee. So you can just download the full PDF of the book for free. And that has everything available just for everyone who is interested. So don't buy our book.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Renzo.